Yes, monsieur.
I think we'll pack up early tonight. There's something I want to do in the village.
Very good, monsieur.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Back then it was Colin Powell, now it's Mike Pompeo, deja vu from 2003 as the State Department demonise Iran. How much more horrific for everyone except the oil and the arms industry, of course, would an illegal war with Iran be than that with Iraq? We zoom in on the Persian Gulf and the Gulf of Oman tonight. Why we need to know exactly what's going on with all those oil tankers. Also, clashes in Hong Kong. Extradition to China is the big issue. Could this have anything to do with the imprisonment of Huawei chief financial officer and the threat to extradite her from Canada to the United States? Or, for that matter, Julian Assange from the UK to the US? And 20 years after the Kosovo War, the Declaration of Independence, one of the catalysts for the breakup of Tito's Yugoslavia. Well, it was a model East meets West former state, which is now dominated by NATO and Western interests. The presidential candidate in Montenegro, for example, was arrested for alleged fraud on election day and has recently undergone a show trial because it looked like he might get elected. We hear from UK Defence Secretary at the time, who went on to become NATO Secretary General, and of course, Bilderberger George Robertson. Also, Libya, the remnants of one of the two great examples with Yugoslavia of social justice in the world, destroyed. Colonel Gaddafi framed and executed by the mob. Our sister show Dialect is here on BCFM Tuesday at noon. This week, a tribute to Martin Cosgrave, co-founder of Dialect with me, who died last week in Malaga, Spain. A Dialect interview from 2006, and some satirical songs by Martin's much-loved Dialect satirist Stanley Forbes. I talk about Dialect's early days in Armada Place and at the Trinity Centre, and of course some more of Martin's tunes. You can listen here at BCFM 93.2 at noon next Tuesday, or download the show right now from dialectradio.co.uk. But we start, Martin, this week in the Straits of Hormuz. Both of them were Japanese oil tankers. Rather nasty fires on them, and something a little bit more than last time, which were basically superficial damage. This is a very important part of the world, isn't it?
It is. I'm not quite sure they were both Japanese. I think one was Japanese and one was something else, but that's just a matter of detail, really. Very, very dangerous and worrying developments here, no doubt about it. The potential for something to go horribly wrong is very much there. And, of course, the British have lined up with the Americans to say that they think the Iranians did it. The Iranians, of course, immediately they've gone to the United Nations, I believe, today to say that they think it's a false flag attack by somebody else. The UAE looked into the previous attack and they said it was definitely a state actor, but they didn't point the finger at Iran. And that means, of course, that the obvious suspects here have got to be the Israelis, basically.
Why?
Why? Because they want a war with Iran. They've been saying it pretty clearly for the last 10 years. We want a war with Iran. Now, in actual fact, the ordinary folk in Britain don't want a war with Iran, and most of the people in America probably don't. So they've got to be given a casus belli. And it looks very similar to me, like the Gulf of Tonkin incident in 1967, in which the Americans pretended that their ships were under attack and then declared war on North Vietnam. Turned out subsequently that nothing of the kind had happened. There was something had happened, but it wasn't what they said.
President Trump today has said that if Iran blocks the Straits of Hormuz, it's not going to be closed for long.
Well, I don't see how he's going to open it. If you fight a war to open it, then no ships are going to go there anyway. Closing it is actually easy. They'd have to land marines on the inside Iran, a hostile landing, Their ships are terribly vulnerable. This isn't D-Day. The Iranians have got missiles that can take down virtually any ship. And, of course, the other thing they'll do is just smash up all of the oil facilities on the other side of the Gulf. And push the oil price through the roof, crash the US economy, and then they won't be able to pay their own soldiers. So the soldiers will be, Marines will be storming onto the beaches of Iran, but their pay will won't be able to pay them because the economy's crashed.
Now, let's have a listen to US Secretary of State and Christian Zionist Mike Pompeo now. And here he is speaking yesterday, I think, or maybe... certainly within the last 24 hours about this attack and why he believes Iran is responsible.
It is the assessment of the United States government that the Islamic Republic of Iran is responsible for the attacks that occurred in the Gulf of Oman today. This assessment is based on intelligence, the weapons used, the level of expertise needed to execute the operation, recent similar Iranian attacks on shipping, and the fact that no proxy group operating in the area has the resources and proficiency to act with such a high degree of sophistication. This is only the latest in a series of attacks instigated by the Islamic Republic of Iran and its surrogates against American and allied interests. And they should be understood in the context of 40 years of unprovoked aggression against freedom-loving nations. On April 22nd, Iran promised the world that it would interrupt the flow of oil through the Strait of Hormuz. It is now working to execute on that promise. In early May, the Revolutionary Guard Corps attempted the covert deployment of modified dhows capable of launching missiles. On May 12th, Iran attacked four commercial ships near the Strait of Hormuz. On May 14th, Iran-backed surrogates attacked by armed drones struck two strategically important oil pipelines in the Saudi Arabia. On May 19th, a rocket landed near the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad. On May 31st, a car bomb in Afghanistan wounded four U.S. service members, killed four Afghan civilians, and wounded bystanders. Yesterday, Iranian surrogates fired a missile into Saudi Arabia, striking the arrivals terminal of an international airport, injuring 26 people. Taken as a whole, these unprovoked attacks present a clear threat to international peace and security, a blatant assault on the freedom of navigation, and an unacceptable campaign of escalating tension by Iran. Prime Minister Abe made a historic trip to Iran to ask the regime to de-escalate and enter into talks. Iran's supreme leader rejected Prime Minister Abe's diplomacy today by saying he has no response to President Trump and will not answer. The supreme leader's government then insulted Japan by attacking a Japanese oil tanker just outside of Iranian waters, threatening the lives of the entire crew, creating a maritime emergency. Iran's foreign minister today responded to these attacks. He said sardonically, quote, "Suspicious doesn't begin to describe what likely transpired this morning," end of quote. Foreign Minister Zarif may think this is funny, but no one else in the world does. Iran is lashing out because the regime wants our successful maximum pressure campaign lifted. No economic sanctions entitle the Islamic Republic to attack innocent civilians, disrupt global oil markets, and engage in nuclear blackmail. The international community condemns Iran's assault on the freedom of navigation and the targeting of innocent civilians.
Well, my immediate response to that is pot, kettle, black. The idea that the Americans have got any credibility when it comes to these situations is absolutely wrong. I mentioned the Gulf of Tonkin incident from the 1960s.
Okay, Martin, let's just stop you right there, because he's saying quite rightly that the Iranians are refusing to talk. And actually, the Japanese have been over there saying, we think you should talk.
No, what the Iranians have said is they talked to the Americans and they did a deal with them, which everybody signed up for. They signed up for it, the Americans signed up for it. And then Trump, for his own reasons, just basically to make the Israelis happy, just ripped it up. Now, at that point, the Iranians are saying, and then they put sanctions on the Iranians, so they're basically, the goal is to stop all Iranian oil being sold.
Deals can be renegotiated like that, surely?
No, but what the Iranians are saying at this stage is, we're not talking to you until you come back to the deal that you've already signed with us. Because if you're not going to stick to deals that you've already signed, there's not much point talking about anything else, is there? It's a waste of time.
And what about this series of unprovoked attacks he describes there? I mean, well, Afghanistan, well,
this,
Iraq,
is, this, is, I mean, this is one of the things that makes me extremely suspicious about this. Why do you have to put all these different incidents into one basket as if they're all the same stuff? There's all sorts of different
That's
things going
he,
on there.
The Americans believe the Iranians are behind all of these
Well,
incidents.
They may believe it, but it's, there's no proof that they're behind any of it, to be honest with you. And in actual fact, it doesn't make sense. It's actually it's come out very recently, and the chemical weapons people have pointed out that the Douma chemical weapons attack was entirely fabricated. We fired off loads of missiles.
He didn't mention that, did he?
No, he didn't, because in actual fact, it had been proved completely wrong. And we know, as Pompeo himself said, we lie, we cheat, we steal. And then he laughed to in front of an audience of students in the US, and they all laughed. Now, when you go to an audience in public and say, we lie, we cheat, we steal, but you should believe every word we say, I go, ha, 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 ha. We don't believe you. We know that you're involved in false flag terrorism. The Brookings report, Which Path to Persia, which was written, you know, quite a while ago, now a decade ago, is basically saying we will have to provoke the Iranians by using false flag attacks. It's all in their own internal documentation. And it's basically what they openly say is that we're going to provoke them in all kinds of different ways in order to get regime change in Iran. And that's what the Americans want, and that's what these, well, some Americans want, and that's what the Israelis want. Do we want it?
What about the Iranian promise on the 22nd of April to close the Straits of Hormuz?
What they said is, if you stop us exporting our oil, we won't let you export your oil. It's as simple as that. Don't forget, sanctions are an act of war in themselves. People in Iran are starving because of the sanctions on the country over many years, just like in Venezuela and elsewhere. And if the Americans were blockaded by the Soviet Union and they were told, you change your policy, otherwise we're not going to let you export your oil, what would they do? They'd go to war with them, wouldn't they?
Well, it wasn't just Mike Pompeo speaking about this. It was also the acting US ambassador to the United Nations, Jonathan Cohen.
It's unacceptable for any party to attack commercial shipping. The United States assesses that Iran is responsible for these attacks. No proxy group in the area has the resources or skill to act with this level of sophistication. Iran, however, has the weapons, the expertise, and the requisite intelligence information to pull this off. And Iran is doing just what it promised. Tehran declared on April 22nd that it would interrupt the flow of oil through the Straits of Hormuz.
Well, I put this to the gentleman, that in actual fact, the other intelligence agencies with the sophistication to carry this off are A, Mossad, B, the CIA, and C, the Saudi Arabian Mukhabarat, all of which have been engaged in all of this stuff. And the attack on Saudi Arabia, don't forget, thousands of people have been killed in Yemen by a completely unacceptable war of aggression, which Britain is supporting. And if the other side shoots back, they're supposedly terrorists. Now, we're moving towards having a war here. But, of course, the Iranians, for perfectly reasonably, from their point of view, might conclude, we're not waiting for you to hit us, we're going to hit you first, because we know you're planning to attack us. And we're not just hanging around waiting for that. Why would we? You wouldn't. We're not going to.
But surely nobody, Saudi Arabia included, actually wants a war, because they may lose it with Iran.
Well, this is this is really questionable, isn't it? If they're going
well,
to
you're, you're putting forward the possibility that the Saudi intelligence service may have been behind this.
They've
got no wish.
In my view, more likely Mossad. They've done it to make it look as if it was the Iranians, which is very sophisticated. You're right, sophisticated false flag. Just as sophisticated as the Gulf of Tonkin incident in 1967. And if you think that the American deep state has got more scrupulous than it was in the 1960s, you're completely wrong. They're probably twice or three times as bad as they were back then. And they're quite capable of doing stuff like this in order to make people look bad. They've even talked about it in their internal... we've got people on YouTube talking at various conferences saying, well, if we're going to get the war with Iran we want, we're going to have to use a false flag and pretend that they started something. And they openly discuss it, and there's no reason to take the word of the Americans about this at all. They've lied about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, they lied about the incubator babies in Kuwait, they lied about the Gulf of Tonkin incident, they lie about everything, basically. You can presume pretty much that whatever they say, it ain't true. You can tell they're lying because their lips are moving.
The BBC World Service's Dan Damon spoke this morning to Saeed Mohammed Massari, too, from Tehran University in Iran, about this incident.
Pompeo has zero credibility. He's the same person who just recently gave a speech and said, as the CIA chief, he was a liar, a cheater, and a thief. And we also remember the Colin Powell UN Security Council presentation on the war against Iraq, where he provided evidence that Iraq was producing weapons of mass destruction. And we also know that the CIA under Trump has established an organization especially for Iran to gather information and for covert action. This was reported in the Wall Street Journal. So I don't think anything that the United States says on Iran is based on objective analysis or based on good intentions.
What about the video of apparently Iranian military sailors removing a limpet mine that hadn't exploded from the side of one of the vessels?
Well, if it was the American Navy that had removed the mine, we would have seen Iranian drone footage of them removing it. So what does that prove? It proves absolutely nothing. This is just psychological
warfare. It proves they knew it was there, and I suppose the implication, and this is what I suspect you will deny, but the implication is that they knew it was there because they put it there and it didn't explode.
How do you know that they put it there? If they knew it was there, it was because the Iranians were rescuing people on the ship. It was the Iranians who rescued the people on the ship. Why is it if American sailors go and remove a mine, then no one would say that the Americans put it there? They knew it was there. Obviously, someone is going to find it. And since the Iranian Navy was competent and Iranians were competent and were quick to, especially since it was close to the Iranian shore, and they were quick to rescue the people, they discovered whatever it is that was discovered there.
When in April the U.S. said it would no longer abide by the waivers on oil exports from Iran, the response from Iran was that they would threaten, well, there was a threat to the passage of oil tankers through the Gulf. Now, what do you think that actually means, and is that what's happening here?
No, of course that's not what's happening. Iran is exporting oil, and of course what the United States did was a violation of international law, and the United States is bullying other countries not to do business with Iran. And the Iranians, as I said, are continuing to export oil. If Iran wanted to block the Strait of Hormuz, then they would have blocked it.
The people you talk to, when you're coming to the university, your students, how afraid are they that the escalation is unstoppable?
Actually, people are much less afraid than you think. I'm actually very surprised how calm people are about this. And I think it's because Iranians recognize that Trump is isolated internationally, and that the likes of Pompeo and Bolton have zero credibility, and that Western allies such as Mohammed bin Salman of Saudi Arabia are reviled across the world.
That's Syed Mohammed Massari there, speaking from Tehran University to Dan Damon on the BBC World Service, Martin.
Yeah, well, I think that was a fairly sober analysis of the situation. I think the point about the Iranian naval vessel is well made. They're basically kelping the crew off the ship, and they've got people around there, and they see this mine on the side of the ship, and they say, well, let's have a look at that. Where's that come from? Don't forget, they're in Iranian territorial waters here. They're the ones responsible for trying to solve the problem.
I mean, the other
thing is, they get hold of the mine, they say, well, where did this mine come from? Ah, it looks like one that's
well,
linked
we haven't
to
been
whoever
told
planted the
whose mine it was. We haven't told what
no,
make
also
of
the people
mine
on the ships,
whatever.
Tony, said that there were actually missiles involved. That's one of the
but
things.
I mean,
that
well, another interesting thing there, he said, and I'm not sure whether you think it's true or not, is that Iran is not worried about this potential war. That strikes me as being quite in parallel with the news, well, suppressed news, really, from Lebanon, where they're saying, well, they're not actually really afraid of an Israeli invasion of Lebanon either. They've been preparing for these attacks for years. And yet, with Iran, surely this is an unthinkable way direction to go. But I think we had the same sort of conversation back in 2003, didn't we, saying Iraq was going to be unthinkable.
Well, indeed. And I think that the in Iran and Hezbollah in Lebanon, etc., and of course all the fighting that's gone on in Syria, where the Syrian Arab army has taken hundreds of thousands of casualties, these people are calm because they know that if it comes to a fight, they're going to win. they're going to suffer terribly, but the other side are basically lost their marbles if they think they're going to win. And because all of the advantages lie with the defenders here. And the US is fighting thousands of miles away from home. All of its ships are incredibly vulnerable. And let's do a thought experiment. If it was the Iranians doing this, and I don't accept that for a minute, the message they're sending is, think about how vulnerable you are if you start shooting at us, because we might shoot back.
I mean, there are several think tanks in London. They call them think tanks. They're foreign policy think tanks. Some of them even seem to have more money than the Foreign Office to decide on foreign policy, since they're privately funded through big corporations, etc. And one of them is the Royal Institute for International Affairs, but another one is called the Royal United Services Institute, and Middle East specialist Anissa Tabrizi was also on the World Service giving her views on the attacks on these tankers yesterday.
The first thing to assess is whether it was Iran or whether it was some sort of false flag operation. If it was Iran, then first of all, I wouldn't discard it completely as an option.
And when you say false flag, you mean that somebody's doing it because somebody in Washington thinks it would be a good idea to have a war in Iran and let's stir things up. Really?
This is something that has been flagged by other analysts as well as a potential. And given the situation, even with previous attacks in the Gulf, in particular to the UAE, close to the UAE, and the fact that the evidence was not corroborated by other countries, it's still plausible that more evidence needs to be clarified and assessed by other countries before we know who was behind it and whether Iran was actually behind it. What I'm saying is that Iran has been talking about the Strait of Hormuz and the possibility of playing with the closure of it since at least 2012, when the oil embargo was imposed by the EU. It has not done it yet. If Iran was behind this, then, of course, the translation of this message is that the status quo is no longer acceptable for Iran. Iran is no longer playing with the strategic patience that it was using up until now, and is basically upping its game and gambling with the potential response from other countries, including the United States. Even the CENTCOM has disregarded any kind of potential military confrontation, despite the accident that happened yesterday and despite the video footage that was shared as evidence that Iran was behind it. I think neither side, nor even Israel and Saudi Arabia, want a direct confrontation. It's easier to have this sort of proxy escalation and asymmetric warfare, if you wish. However, the problem with this type of confrontation is that it can inevitably escalate or translate into something that neither of the sides wanted in the first place.
So that was from the Royal United Services Institute, Anissa Tabrizi, who's a Middle East expert. Martin, interesting there, she's talking immediately about false flags and saying that CENTCOM, who very rarely get a mention, but are very much involved in military matters in the Middle East, apparently they have discounted the idea of any military action.
Yeah, well, I think that, you know, there's what you might call sober analysis. A war would be totally destructive for both sides, and military action in this situation, you can't guarantee victory. So, you know, if there's any common sense, you'd think that they wouldn't want to go.
Well,
there.
They couldn't guarantee victory in Vietnam or Afghanistan.
No. The point that she made at the end of the contribution there, that accidents can happen, is pretty much the real point. Both sides are playing brinkmanship, but actually the Iranians are basically being calm and trying to reason with the unreasonable people they're dealing with. The other side are, you know, it's what they call the madman theory of warfare in Vietnam. So Kissinger would go and talk to the North Vietnamese, look, I'm a reasonable guy and I'll do a deal with you, but Nixon, he's mad, he'll just nuke you. And Nixon's on the other side of the room go, I'm really mad, I'm going to nuke you. And of course, that's supposedly a nice cop, nasty cop way of dealing with people. But of course, in actual fact, if you start making idle threats, you end up having to carry them out. Otherwise, you look stupid. And that's the danger, is that everybody gets backed into a corner. You know, somebody shoots Archduke Ferdinand, the Austrians then put impossible demands on the Serbs about what to do about it, and before you know it, we're all at war.
Well, this is the thing with the Straits of Hormuz and Iran, is it could actually be that sort of house of cards or domino effect situation, bringing in the Russians, the United States and the Chinese.
Well, it might, because Iranians have got Chinese and Russian allies, but I suspect what they would do if it came to warfare is let the Iranians do their own fighting, but with political support from the Chinese and the Russians demanding immediate ceasefire. That's what I would imagine would happen. But, of course, it would be very, very destructive very quickly. The Iranians can seal off the Gulf completely, so any allied shipping, you know, in the Gulf will be sunk straight away. So any Royal Navy ships, for example, on the wrong side of the Gulf of Hormuz, they'll be sunk, and everybody on board will drown. That's what will happen, and that will happen in the first half an hour. All of the oil platforms on the other side of the Gulf, which is where most Saudi oil is all on that side of the Gulf, it's very, very vulnerable. That will all be smashed to pieces immediately
by
missiles.
In the meantime, just to the west of this area is Yemen, and this war raging. And it looks as if actually the Yemeni forces, the Houthi rebels, they call them, have been making inroads north up in towards Riyadh, towards Mecca, and into Saudi Arabia.
Well, indeed. I mean, the Saudis invaded a few years ago, presuming it was going to be a walkover, a cakewalk, and in actual fact, they're bogged down in an absolutely unwinnable war. They don't want to negotiate their way out, because then they'd have to accept that it was all wrong. So we, the British, are supporting the Saudis to carry on killing children in Yemen. And, of course, when they shoot back at our oil pipeline, they're terrorists. Of course they are. Like the bombing of Hamburg, that wasn't terrorism, was it? It was warfare. No, it was terrorism. I don't know. It's just silly. The use of words here, the use of language, is a way of trying to control people's minds.
Also, looking at today's reporting of this in the Mirror, they say Oman oil tanker attacks crew held captive in Iran after the gunboats surround the ship. They're talking about these two ships. One of them, let's get the details of those, the Japanese-owned Kokura Courageous and the Norwegian-owned Front Altair, have rattled global oil markets, escalating tensions between these various nations. So, yeah, one Norwegian and one Japanese tanker. But, Martin, they're also talking in this report about torpedoes as well.
Yeah, well, the crew apparently was saying that there's something like missiles or torpedoes rather than mines, you know. Anyway, the point about any of these incidents is you've got to look into them
submarines.
Properly.
It brings in the possibility of submarines.
Or aircraft or something else.
Yeah.
And don't forget, if you're going to carry out a false flag attack, the Iranian Navy definitely has the capability to sink big ships with small boats. You know, they've got the, you know, small, very fast speed boats which can sink big ships. Now, if you're going to carry out a false flag attack, you carry out something that looks like an Iranian-style commando raid. But I would suggest to you that this is my copper's hunch, this is a false flag from inside the US security forces working with Mossad.
In this reporting, I just find incredible, really. It says the crew of both vessels, remember one is actually burning on fire, were forced to abandon ship, they're saying, by the Iranians, actually.
Well, the Iranians just turned up to rescue the people on the ship.
But this is the US Central Command spokesperson saying this. He said the Iranian forces told a ship that had rescued sailors from the Altair to turn the crew over to the Iranian fast inshore craft. So the other thing, of course, is the idea of US drones hovering around as the Iranians are rescuing. Now, that, I suppose, is just part of modern warfare nowadays. These drones, see, these ships, the aircraft carriers, etc., will carry drones that can go a long distance away and just watch what's going on.
This is all taking place, as I understand it, inside Iranian territorial waters. So in actual fact, the foreign navies are not, in fact, entitled to have anything to do with this. And the real problem for the people who want to attack Iran is that the actual navigable bit of the Straits of Hormuz, the bit that big tankers have to use, is all inside Iranian territorial waters. So when they say we're going to close the Straits of Hormuz, it'll be like us saying we're going to stop ships in the English Channel because we, you know, the English Channel has actually got a, you know, there's a way through the middle of it. But they would be perfectly within their rights to close their own territorial waters to foreign shipping if that's what they thought they needed to do. And then no ships could go through the Straits of Hormuz without breaking the rule. You know, the Iranians are perfectly within their rights if they wish to close it. Nobody can stop them. Not legally, anyway.
Oil prices leap, a big increase in oil prices as well, with things like this going on. I mean, actually, this is a relatively minor attack, isn't it? I mean, even though...
Yeah, but it starts... What it does is it means the insurance market, Lloyd's and all these other people, start to raise the price of, insuring ships to go through there. And once they start doing that, then the oil price starts to climb upwards, which is not necessarily something that people who run the oil industry are that bothered about. You know, if oil prices rise, especially when there's a bit of a glut and so on, they might be quite happy with that.
So the tanker owner is contradicting, apparently, the United States version of events. The owner of the Japanese tanker that was attacked on Thursday, the Kokuka Outrageous, says the two tankers were hit with limpet mines, a type of mine that's attached to the hull of a ship below the waterline using magnets. But the owner of the Kokuka Outrageous said he received reports that a projectile hit the ship. So, I mean, that's either a missile or a torpedo. So the US seemed to have got that wrong.
Well, that's what he's saying. You know, if there was any objectivity in all of this, we'd start to try and untangle what had happened.
He's saying, actual words are, we received reports that something flew towards the ship, he said at a press conference. The place where the projectile landed was significantly higher than the water level, so we're absolutely sure this was not a torpedo. Oh, right.
Yeah. So, in other words, the Americans are definitely contradicting the owner of the ship. That is clear. Now, don't forget, when Rafik Hariri was assassinated in Lebanon some years ago, it was supposedly a culvert bomb planted by Hezbollah, but Hezbollah then gave a press conference where they got the video footage from the Israeli drone which had actually fired the missile which killed Rafik Hariri. And, of course, in Iraq, frequently what were supposedly bombs planted in cars turned out to be airstrikes by US forces. And the fact about this is that they've been doing this kind of complex psychological warfare operations for years. And as was pointed out earlier, Pompeo even boasted not long ago, we lie, we cheat, we steal. Believe everything we say.
Also, I mean, the big question, Martin, is why would Iran attack two tankers?
Well, indeed. You just have to ask yourself the simple question. If the Iranians did this, all they're doing is creating a load of problems for themselves.
I mean,
why would they do it?
There are other things going on in the region. I mentioned the Houthis moving north into Saudi Arabia from Yemen. Also, I mean, just thinking about the geography of it all for a minute. It's a big peninsula, the Arabian Peninsula. On the left-hand side is the Suez Canal at the top, and you've got the Red Sea. And then on the right-hand side, you've got the Persian Gulf. The Straits of Hormuz in the middle. And then the Gulf of Oman moves out into the Arabian Sea, which is really part of the Indian Ocean. So I'm just looking at the sort of geography of this. This is all along the southern edge of Iran. All this is taking place, which, of course, has been for a long time. These various military bases. We're talking about Bahrain, Oman, UAE, of course, all the way along there, and Qatar.
Well, yes, I mean, you've just given a brief geographical description, but, and of course, the geography...
Okay, Bahrain and Qatar, there's been a whole sort of dispute about whether arms should be being sold from the US to then. We've heard today the US Senate has upholding arms sales to Bahrain and Qatar, and also the Defence Secretary in the US arms the Saudis to prevent Russia and China from arming them. So, apparently, there's a big competition to sell arms to the Saudis, and so that's why the US... Secretary of Defense is saying, well, we can't stop US arms sales to Saudi Arabia because if we didn't sell them weapons, they'd get them from Russia and China.
Well, the Russians have basically offered the Saudis the S-400, which is a cheaper and better alternative to the American FAD system or whatever it is they're offering.
But as a result of that discussion in the US, Senator Rand Paul, whoever he is, I'm not sure who he is.
He's the son of Ron Paul.
Who is...
Ron Paul is a libertarian candidate for president over many years. We'll talk about him in a minute.
Rand Paul is warning the US is arming its enemies. Actually, the people like the Saudi Arabians don't like us.
Well, that's true, but of course, in actual fact, the idea...
And of course, they were supposedly behind 9/11 attacks. Bin Laden was a Saudi Arabian.
And surprisingly enough, when Trump said that people from Islamic countries weren't allowed to come to the US, That didn't include the Saudis, because, of course, the Bush family, the Bin Laden family, being friendly with the Bush family for years, etc., etc. Even though 19 of the supposed hijackers on 9/11 were all Saudi Arabians, no, Saudis can come and go freely. But people from Pakistan can't.
Anyway, just
because they're Muslims.
Round up this discussion. I think it's good plan to go back to 2003, 16 years ago, and the horrific parallels that there are between these so-called fake evidence being presented that the Iran now is behind this, and the same sort of thing that we had with the weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. So I thought we'd go and find a former Bristol MP, Tony Benn, and what he had to say in the Iraq debate back 16 years ago.
War is an easy thing to talk about. There are not many people of the generation that remember it. The Right Honourable Gentleman served with distinction. The last war, I never killed anyone, but I wore uniform. But I was in London in the Blitz in 1940, living in the Millbank Tower where I was born. Some different ideas have come in since. And every night I went down to the shelter in Thames House. Every morning I saw Dockland burning. 500 people were killed in Westminster one night by a landmine. It was terrifying. Aren't Arabs terrified? Aren't Iraqis terrified? Don't Arab and Iraqi women weep when their children die? Doesn't bombing strengthen their determination? What fools we are to live in of a generation for which war is a computer game for our children and just an interesting little Channel 4 news item. Every Member of Parliament tonight who votes for the government motion will be consciously and deliberately accepting the responsibility for the deaths of innocent people if the war begins, as I fear it will. Now, that's for their decision to take. But this is a quite unique debate in my parliamentary experience where we're asked to share responsibility for a decision we won't really be taking, with consequences for people who have no part to play in the brutality of the regime which we are dealing with. And I finish with this. On October the 24th, 1945, and the former Prime Minister from Bexley and Old Sidcup will remember it, the United Nations Charter was passed. And the words of that charter etched into my mind and moved me even as I think of them. We, the people of the United Nations, determined to save succeeding generations from the scourge of war, which twice in our lifetime has caused untold suffering to mankind. That was the pledge of that generation to this generation, and it would be the greatest betrayal of all if we voted to abandon the Charter and take unilateral action and pretend we were doing it in the name of the international community. And I shall vote against the motion for the reasons that I've given the House.
That's a former Bristol MP and also Chesterfield MP, Tony Benn Martin, speaking at the time of the debate on the Iraq war back in 2003.
Well, that's right. And it's like people don't even know what happened yesterday, never like what happened the day before. We are basically on a slippery slope to a war that most people don't want, although it's absolutely clear that the Israeli government wants a war with Iran. They've never made a secret of it. They want us to fight Iran for them. The question is, do we want to do that to help them? Especially when they're involved, quite possibly, if you finally had a proper police investigation in this and you found that Mossad were involved, maybe we could get their people extradited to stand trial in Iran. That would be interesting, wouldn't it?
On to looking at, whilst you're mentioning extradition, Martin, onto this Hong Kong story, and related to it, of course, is this, well, although I say, of course, I've not heard anybody on the mainstream press making these comparisons, but the idea that people might be extradited from Hong Kong to China really is pales into insignificance in the way, in comparison to the possible extradition of the journalist Julian Assange to the United States from the UK, and the Huawei chief financial officer from Canada to the US as well. So it's hardly surprising me the Chinese are thinking, and in Hong Kong they're thinking about extraditing people into mainland China.
Well, it is. I mean, there's obviously a legitimate cause for concern here by people of Hong Kong. But as you say, you know, the West basically, we're running secret prisons all over the world. The US and the British The British are definitely involved. There are secret prisons all over the world, probably with hundreds, possibly thousands of people in them. We don't know where they are. Some were in Poland, some were in Romania, some were in Syria, we understand, before the fighting started against the government. And loads of people are held there without any kind of legal representation at all. They're tortured. We know they're tortured. And then people like al-Baghdadi are then released, and then they come back as terrorists. But of course, their strings are being pulled, as everybody in the Syrian army knows.
The UK Home Secretary Sajid Javid has signed a US extradition order for Julian Assange. Home Secretary has opened the way for the court to consider whether Assange should be sent to the United States. He's revealed he's signed a request for Assange to be extradited to the US, where he faces charges of computer hacking. Speaking on Radio 4's Today programme, Javid said he's rightly behind bars.
Well, I mean, that's just wrong. He's not rightly behind bars at all. And when it comes to the court, I would hope that top English barristers are going to take them to pieces on that one. And of course, he's not being extradited for computer hacking. He's going to be charged with espionage under the Espionage Act, 17 counts. Which is, and of course, the Espionage Act was rushed through Congress in 1917 to crush the opposition to the First World War. So Eugene Debs, who was the head of the Socialist Party, had millions of voters in America. He was sent to prison under the Espionage Act, and it's hardly ever used. It's an archaic piece of legislation, and of course, it's not anything. Nothing Assange has done is a crime in British law, and he's not even a US citizen. So the legal basis for this is minimal to non-existent.
These comparisons aren't being made about extradition, because the Huawei chief financial officer being arrested in Canada and then potentially extradited to the United States, this is incredibly serious, isn't it, really, for East-West relations?
Well, what's going on is that the US are basically, and they've done it quite a lot, they're saying that their courts override everybody else's. So, for example, Peter Singer and the vulture capitalists in New York bought up Argentinian debt with pennies on, you know, pesos on the dollar price, and then they use the U.S. courts in New York to demand the full payment from Argentina, even though the Argentine courts had already decided that everything had been settled. So what the U.S. are trying to do, a bit, you know, they used to go on about the Soviet Union is a really weird country because it's got no limits to its territorial scope. You know, they want to conquer the world and turn it all into a Soviet state. And the US are basically saying the whole world has to accept the decisions of our courts as more superior to their own courts, even though there's no basis for that. And the British, as always, Sajid Javid is just going along with this. It's actually, when we're talking about, parliamentary sovereignty and Magna Carta and all the rest of it, what's happening to Assange is an outrage against all of those principles. It just is.
In Hong Kong, the leader's advisors are urging extradition pause. So the chief executive of Hong Kong, it's almost like it's a company nowadays.
Well, it always was, Tony.
Still is. Carrie Lam's advisors have urged her to delay plans for a controversial change in extradition laws. Some still back the process. But there is no evidence she intends to delay it. Big protests, some of the biggest ever in Hong Kong, took place this week to oppose a bill that could see some criminal suspects extradited to mainland China. Hundreds of thousands took to the street on Sunday and Wednesday. They believe, again, more protests this coming Sunday. But what happened on Wednesday? Let's have a listen now to Martin Yip, who's the BBC's Hong Kong correspondent.
People were just chasing each other. Some sort of missiles were thrown, but not in this scale. It did happen in the later days of Occupy movement, where some young protesters tried to storm the chief executive office on the other side of this whole complex that we call Tama. It used to be HMS Tama, the old Royal Navy headquarters before the 1997 handover. So this time, around 3 p.m. Hong Kong time, sometime after lunch, these protesters gathered outside the entrance to the drop-off area of the Legislative Council complex. They started storming the police, throwing all sorts of rockets, including bricks, and some noise shields and all that, and we ended up with police chasing back, firing tear gas and what they call tear spray, apparently some sort of dilute pepper spray, and of course pepper spray.
So that's basically what was happening on Wednesday, and he was comparing it briefly there to the umbrella protests back in 2014 or 2015. So 22 police and 60 protesters were injured, Martin. The protesters actually got right into the legislative building and made it impossible for them to meet to discuss this new law.
Well, do you remember when the students stormed Tory Party headquarters here? When about the student loans issue? They were all prosecuted, weren't they? Maybe they shouldn't have been.
Maybe they should have been extradited to China.
Yeah, maybe so.
So what do you think's the outcome here? Because it's almost like a disaster waiting to happen in Hong Kong, because China has big military units in Hong Kong, which are not allowed at the moment to come out onto the streets. But of course, if there is really serious civil unrest, they will almost certainly do that, won't they?
Well, they will. I mean, this is a very delicate balancing act that's got to be pursued. And don't forget, things would be a lot easier if we didn't have this trade war stroke real war going on between China and Trump and all the rest of it. One of the things that may happen, if don't forget, Hong Kong is not treated as part of China for trade purposes, okay? So the Trump's tariffs on Chinese goods and so on don't apply to Hong Kong. But ultimately, of course, they might. And at that point, then Hong Kong's economy is very vulnerable anyway. It's a massive property bubble like everywhere else in the world. And if you do get kind of what you might call unrest, really, in Hong Kong, it's quite possible that the market will collapse and everybody's going to lose their jobs. And then it won't be such an attractive place for people to go there anyway. Well, you see, from the Chinese point of view, they don't want triads from mainland China just going off to Hong Kong to hide out.
Meng Huanzhou is the chief financial officer of Huawei, still under arrest in Canada. Although no trial or anything, no judicial process so far. Canada, we hear yesterday, has rejected the idea of halting the extradition of top Huawei executive to the United States. That's in a Reuters report. Canadian Foreign Minister Chrystia Freeland, not very Freeland yesterday, was it? On Thursday, dismissed a suggestion that Ottawa might block the extradition of top executive from China's Huawei technologies to the US. Say it would set a dangerous precedent. I think actually the extradition sets a dangerous precedent.
Well, yes, it depends what side of this view you're on. Don't forget, what she's accused of is breaking sanctions on Iran, which nobody else accepts should be there anyway. So it's only the Americans who are insisting that there are sanctions on Iran. Virtually everybody else says there shouldn't be sanctions on Iran. And she's basically being accused of breaking American law on sanctions to Iran,
well,
even though she's Chinese.
China reacted by detaining two Canadians on spying charges. It's also blocked imports of Canadian canola seed. And Prime Minister Justin Trudeau said he fears further retaliation.
Well, I mean, what is happening on global affairs at the moment is extremely worrying, isn't it? We've got various flashpoints. Certain individuals are being singled out, Assange, this woman.
Yeah,
and
I
so
just
on.
Wonder what you mean.
Where's it all going to end? Well,
possibility. Probably, eh? Actually, what the Chinese are up to in Hong Kong is actually you could see it as a chess move, a sort of reaction to the extradition of Meng Huanzhou, for example.
Well, it might be. I understand the Chinese position is this. That, you know, you have a fairly bad organised crime problem in mainland China. The triads are very powerful. And one of the problems that the police in China have if they're dealing with organised crime is that when the going gets a bit hot, they all just disappear to Hong Kong. Just like the Russian mafia generally tend to run off to Israel. Like Kolomoisky's run off to Israel from Ukraine, although he's coming back, I understand, now that Zelensky's in charge. And yes, I mean, what's going on is a constant escalation of tension. And at some point, this may lead to shooting. Well, there's already shooting going on.
Anyway,
shooting.
Let's go back to international affairs from the past. And this is 20 years ago, Kosovo. And here is the former NATO Secretary General and Defence Secretary, George Robertson, talking about what was really going on with Kosovo and the beginning of the end, the beginning of the end, I think, of the breakup of the former Yugoslavia 20 years ago.
When I was the British Defence Secretary, I lived through the 78 days of the of the campaign, which was pretty unprecedented, it has to be said. You know, we were attacking a sovereign nation state without the benefit of a UN Security Council resolution. So that was, you know, a pretty remarkable thing to do. But we knew why we had to do it, and we set out our objectives very clearly in advance, which were Serbs out, NATO in, refugees home. And maybe unprecedentedly, after 78 days, we actually achieved all three.
Well, it's interesting he said that. He said, Serbs out, NATO in. The demand at Rambouillet on the Serbs was to allow NATO to occupy the whole of Serbia, not just Kosovo, the whole of Serbia. And the Serbs said, we can't accept that. And, of course, it then became clear that, in actual fact, a lot of the massacre at Rakac and other places was basically not as bad as was being suggested. And that we can go, I can say more about it, because, as you know, I used to be an aid worker and I used to have to write briefings about all of this back in the day. But, you know.
So I know you were over there, Martin. Who was this guy, Adam Demacci? Because I know he played a role.
Well, Adam Demacci was a moderate.
Wasn't he an opposition politician?
He was an opposition. But in Kosovo, there's a majority Albanian population, although traditionally Kosovo was part of Serbia. But through demographic changes over the years, and don't forget, in the Second World War, there was a Muslim SS battalion that fought against the Serbs and so on. Yeah? So, you know, there's a lot of, you know, you could argue, well, why the Kosovo Albanians are majority in Kosovo? Well, there was a bit of ethnic cleansing that went on during World War II. But of course, over time, you know, but basically, ultimately, it's a Muslim majority. It was an autonomous region within Yugoslavia. It wasn't an independent. You had two levels of devolution in Yugoslavia. One was constitutive republics like Serbia and Croatia, and to accommodate Kosovan demands in the 70s, Tito gave them autonomous status. So they weren't a full republic of Yugoslavia, but they had autonomy. And of course, on the back of that, you then got all of these conflicts. Kosovo was the last place. You know, the war started in Slovenia at the other end of Yugoslavia, and it went eventually to Kosovo. And it didn't. The war in Kosovo didn't start till quite late, because up to that point, people like Demacci had been pursuing a pretty resolutely non-violent strategy. But the Kosovo Liberation Army, who were working closely with the Western powers and also with Al-Qaeda, were determined to have an armed struggle.
Okay, but
that led to everything traditionally.
There was a quite big influence of Russia in this area, yeah. And but at the time we're talking about 1999, obviously, and Russia was very weak, wasn't it, at the very end of the Yeltsin era. So let's have a listen now. Robertson talks about why the Russians weren't involved.
Well, Russia wasn't part of the effort during the 78 days. Indeed, they were very resistant to it. They claimed that NATO had deceived them, and they were very much on the side of Slobodan Milosevic at the beginning. But later on, when we went in 20 years ago today, Russian tanks came down from Tuzla in Bosnia and grabbed hold of the airport at that time. So there was a bit of a confrontation at that time, memorably, General Jackson said he wasn't going to start World War III over Pristina Airport. But the Russians sent the tanks down. Unfortunately, they didn't send down any water or ammunition or any support for those troops. And indeed, General Jackson had to rescue the Russian troops from a very angry Albanian population at the time. But thereafter, Russia was very much part of the Kosovo force. They had a role to play in Pristina Airport. And it was only very late in the day that the Russian troops left, largely because they were required by the Russian authorities in Chechnya.
Well, you know, that was very close to a shooting war between Russia and the West. very close. At the time, I supported the intervention, although the Israelis didn't, because they understood quite clearly what was going to happen. A precedent was going to be set about what happens when you bomb civilians.
But at the end of the day,
Muslim civilians.
It wasn't a success, really, because only about half of the countries of the world ever recognised Kosovo.
Oh, it's a great disappointment. I think that given the circumstances that were faced by the people of Kosovo, they deserved much better than that. I think recognition, especially by all of the European Union countries, should have been automatic given the background. And I think it's really quite disappointing that, you know, because of other motivations, a worry about secession of parts of countries has led to some of those countries holding back recognition. It'll come eventually, because Kosovo is normalising and it is making its way in the world. So I hope that that's going to happen, because that would be the final accolade for those people who put up with so much at that time.
Well, they're not going to be recognised for the reasons he's mentioned, because breakaways shouldn't just be recognised if they break away. Are they going to recognise Russian control of Crimea? No, they're not, because
okay.
It's a breakaway.
So, but what was the point of it all?
Well, there was all sorts of statements made about NATO out of area or out of business, but that wasn't the motivation. We were involved in Bosnia because of what was happening there, the massive violence and ethnic cleansing taking place at that time. And the operation there was successful after every other attempt at diplomacy had failed. And then we were faced with what was an extermination policy by Milosevic in Kosovo, by the use of rape and torture, mass killings, and cattle trucks, forcing the ethnic Albanian majority population out there. So we had to take action at that time. So it wasn't a matter of choice by NATO. We were forced into it. And I think what it did was to reinforce the view that NATO was largely involved in peace and stability in the wider region. And the fact that we were successful, I think, showed that NATO was an organisation to be reckoned with.
Martin, in a nutshell, what was the point of it?
Well, basically, with hindsight, I think they were determined to break up Yugoslavia.
Time to sign off for the US-owned Comcast News at 8. Thanks to our guest in the first hour, Mike Davis, for Ashley, Labour councillor, also for the Brexit Party, James Glancy. You'll find the show's podcast, short story links and comment page and other contact details at thisweekoneword.org.uk. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable BCFM weekend. Do please join us for the politics show at 6 o'clock next week. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.
Live from the Sky News Centre.